Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm Nan Evans, and I'm here today with Craig Schrader. Craig is the soil scientist with the Jefferson County Conservation District. Welcome, Craig.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be here. I enjoy this radio station and your show.
Well, thank you. Well, in just a few minutes, we'll be talking with Craig about the dirt on soils. But first, as always, we'll start with a mystery sound. And later on in the program, we'll let you know what it is. Well, I can give you a little hint. The genus and species name of this creature is Histrionicus histrionicus. That's from the Latin word histrio for actor. And if you've ever seen this creature, you will never forget it. Now for a few observations and bits of news.
Well, fall is finally here, and the smoke over the Pacific Northwest has finally cleared. Cliff Mass's blog gives us good news. The skies are nearly clear of smoke, and the fires are either out or contained.
That is good news. And up in the sky, last Sunday night, I joined many other Port Townsenders and visitors to the Port Townsend Film Festival downtown along Water Street to view the total eclipse of the moon. The weather was clear as the bright full moon started to fade to red just after dusk fell. Sunday night's full moon is designated as a super moon. That's because it was the closest to the Earth as the moon gets in its elliptical orbit. The moon became totally engulfed in the Earth's shadow, thus making it a total eclipse. Total eclipses of supermoons are relatively rare. The last supermoon lunar eclipse was in 1982, and the next will be in 2033.
And here's another good piece of news. The long-awaited cleanup of Port Gamble is just about ready to launch. Work started this week with the removal of pilings treated with the toxic creosote. A number of other piers, docks, and other structures will also be removed as the project progresses, and contaminated sediments and other muck will be dug out of the bay or capped with clean material. The project is expected to continue into early 2017 and should provide a boost for the bay's health and for the Puget Sound environment in general.
That is good news. I was reading James Swan's book about his 3 years in Shoalwater Bay, which is now Willapa Bay, and he talks about Port Gamble, and this would be 1852 or 3, as being the largest timber mill in the West at that time. Monica Fletcher sent in two amazing observations this week. First, in her yard, she watched a female Merlin chase two Stellar's jays. Monica described the Merlin as sweeping upwards towards the jays and then swooping around the various trees. Monica thought that since the jays were about the same size as the Merlin, it was probably just a case of pure harassment. The Merlins, of course, that we're talking about are not those mythological wizards, but rather small brownish falcons. Secondly, Monica says that she was honored to be present at the Discovery Bay Bird Rescue's release of an adult bald eagle that had been picked up in the water off of North Beach. After rehab to treat a parasitic disease called capillaria, physical rehab, and fattening up, the eagle was released. He flew off towards the Dungeness River Valley. The adult was also accompanied by a second juvenile bald eagle, also released at the same moment. The juvenile eagle had fledged prematurely and needed to be fed and to undergo a molt as well. Quoting Monica, she said, "These glorious huge birds took off with loud wing beats."
Check out the seawall at Boat Haven and Point Hudson. Thousands of visiting Harriman's gulls are hanging out there, probably until late October when they head south to Mexico for mating.
There's so much around here to see. And if listeners have any observations of things you've seen in the natural world around us, please send them to naturenow@kptz.org. That's naturenow, one word, at kptz.org. So now let's go on and talk about soil, Craig. Your bio on the Jefferson County Conservation District's website says that your PhD is focused on agricultural climatology and soil physics. I'm curious. I'm not even sure that I know what that is. And why did you go into that field?
I didn't know what it was either. I was already working as a soil scientist, but I knew I needed a master's degree to sort of expand my career. I saw an opening in that particular field, talked to the person a little bit, and decided it might just be the right fit for me. So serendipity.
Yeah. And what is agricultural climatology?
It's really any of the climate conditions that might impact agriculture in general, like is temperature or moisture, if people need measurements or some kind of an assessment on why their crop did one thing or another, then they might talk to an agricultural climatologist. Or we might look at the historic events that may pertain to growing one crop over another.
So it's a more systems and interactive
yes.
field. Interesting. So when I think of soil, sometimes I think of it as an ecosystem, and sometimes I think of it as a biological community, sometimes just something alive. Other times it's a physical thing. Sometimes I think of it as the sort of medium that supports plants' growth and allows roots to absorb water and nutrients. But what do soil scientists or agricultural climatologists or restoration ecologists think of when they use the word soil? And sort of what is soil?
Most people look at it and see a solid. I look at it and see something a little different. Just from its purely from its physical state, it has four phases that I think of. So there's some organic matter, you know, 3 to 5%. There's minerals made up of sand, silt, and clay, which take up about another 45%. And then there's the pore space. And in the pore space, we hold water that hopefully is available to the plants, but we also hold atmosphere because the plants need oxygen in order to do their mm-hmm. growth. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of those four, and you're looking for certain maybe optimums. You want it to hold a sufficient capacity of water to nurture plant growth, but you also need the oxygen. If all water, you would be in an anaerobic state, mm-hmm. and plants don't like that. We know now that the more organic matter we have, the better the properties of the soil are. And by that, I mean talking about tilth.
What is tilth?
Well, tilth is one of those things I've heard it described this way, and I like this definition, is that you know it when you have it.
But okay.
They say the average farmer can go out and say, that's a good soil or that's not a good soil. But really, tilth says that it's not too compacted. It has organic matter to help hold water, to help with supply nutrients to the plants. It just has a good feeling. There's aggregates in it. It's not compacted into a solid layer. It just has a good feel. So that's
okay.
A very vague definition, I guess.
Okay. And when scientists use the term soil, do they include the living organisms that you find in soils?
I think more and more that's being recognized. One of the other areas of soil science is soil microbiology, in which we're looking at all the different organisms that do live in the soil. One of the things that's important is that a soil not be too compacted. For instance, the largest pore that holds water also makes a pretty good passageway for an earthworm, and it's about a 20th of an inch in diameter. Mm. That's a huge pore. But a root tip is about 1/250th of an inch, but it doesn't want to be encountering a lot of resistance. It wants the ability to explore that volume of soil. So mm-hmm. microorganisms and invertebrates and everything, they all help contribute to creating an environment that's plant happy, I guess, plant healthy.
Plant happy, right. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
So one more just definitional questions. Do scientists think of it differently, dirt or soil, or what's dirt and what's soil? Or
Okay.
Is there a distinction? Are they the same?
I know soil scientists that get very upset when you say dirt, but I'm pretty immune to that. My definition is dirt is under my fingernails. Soil is where I grow my plants. So,
oh, okay.
and that's the dirt on that.
So. Okay. I can live with that. We live out in the North Beach area, and if I were to sort of dig a deep hole, I know I would go through the sort of top soil organic matter, and then where we are, the next thing I would find would be the sand. And I've not dug this hole, but I suppose sooner or later, after many, many feet, I would come into some kind of a bedrock. I guess my question is, how deep is soil? Is there something between soil and bedrock, or is it all soil, or...
I think that there's two answers. There's a kind of a precise answer, and most soil scientists tend to look pretty much the top 5 feet to see what's going on. That's where most of the biological activity takes place.
So is that where most of the roots and the critters would be?
The critters would be.
Top 5 feet, okay.
And so then I say the separation between a soil scientist and a geologist is they could care less about the soil often. They're down deeper, but there's sort of an area of ambiguity that we're both interested in. Probably below 5 feet and where the serious bedrock begins. So if you see the people that classify soils, they're usually digging pits and looking at the different layers and doing interesting little activities like making the soil fizz. But 5 feet, a couple meters is
more or less
that's
soil.
Pretty much okay. where things are happening.
Sometimes we take soil a bit for granted, and I'll not call it dirt, I'll call it soil.
I appreciate that.
Talk to me a bit about the function that soil performs in the ecosystem, and we've talked a little bit like what makes a particular soil healthy for good plant growth.
Soil is as a medium for growing plants is probably our most important thing. At one time in this country, before the Industrial Revolution, we had vast prairies and forests, and they were tying up a lot of carbon in that soil profile.
I've got a question to ask you about that in a bit, too.
Okay, so. I jumped ahead a little.
No. I got that carbon question.
Know, some other simple things, too. It's the beginning of some of the filtering process as water filters down through soil. And of course, this is getting beyond the realm of soil, but this is what purifies our water, our drinking water, when we have groundwater that we use for our wells. There's just a whole bunch of functions that we do. It's an environment for, like I said, all these soil creatures, critters, if some people might go with. I don't know if that answers it or not.
I guess that does. That's it. Sort of throughout the Quimper Peninsula, or sort of in our area, more or less of this area of the world, I don't want to do soil classification, but I want to think just a minute about the kinds of soils we have and how the history of the area, the repeated glaciations, before that some of the tectonic activity, how did that influence the kind of soil we have here?
That's a good question. We're not too different than other areas. The glaciation is what's probably the main driver for the soils we have here, and it's the same thing in the Midwest. So even though we're talking 10 to 12,000 years, we're talking about young soils. And in all the categorization that soil scientists like to do, we have a couple categories. That one is called inceptisol, which is a new soil, or another one called an entisol, which is a recent soil. And really what that speaks to is the amount of time it's had to develop a full profile. Like if you were to go to the Midwest and look at a prairie soil, you would see a deep, rich horizon on the top. Well, here, our horizons tend to be a little bit thinner. We haven't had the time, and that's one of the soil forming factors. We haven't had the time for the soils to fully form. So we need climate, we need time, it depends on the parent material. So mm-hmm. One parent material that we see here that we see nowhere else in the country probably is volcanic materials. Mm-hmm. Not real common, but you do encounter them. So there are these soil forming factors, and because they're all young soils, they're not as fully formed as these soils you might see in other parts of the country. So, And they're also not as depleted as a result.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the other side of the coin.
Yeah. So sort of another question. I know we've all known that this area is experiencing drought conditions. Can you talk just a moment about how different soils respond to the drought and whether plant life on some of these different soils was affected differently because the soils were different?
Yes, definitely. General rule of thumb is that a very sandy soil doesn't hold as much what we call plant available water. Now, the plants can draw water at certain tensions of pressure. Sandy soils, because they tend to be dominated by large, large pores, the water flows through real nicely, which we love when we're trying to have a perk test done. But it also means that the soil moisture depleted rather quickly.
The well-established roadies in my yard had a really tough time this summer.
Exactly. And generally, if a soil like that maybe has lower organic material, and organic matter is another one of the things that helps us have good soil health and hold moisture. So that's one end of the spectrum. On the other end, we have some clayey soils around here, and clay is a good material, but it's the opposite. It has very small pores, so water doesn't flow through it quite as readily. And sometimes what you find is that one of the characteristics of a good soil is that it's well-drained, which means that the water can move through it freely, but not too freely. So there's sort of an optimum in between. So that's why we love these loamy soils.
A loam is a mix?
Loam is a mix of sand, silt, and clay, mm-hmm. and kind of ideal. You know, it occupies a fairly large area of the soils chart. It's why they like it so much. It has water moves through quickly, but it holds quite a bit of water. And
just right, huh?
Yeah, it's kind of like the three bears.
Yeah, okay. So if someone were curious about the type and characteristics of soil on their land, how do they go about finding out about it?
Well, you can come to the conservation district, and you'll probably get me. We can go out and take a look at it. What I often do is years and years ago, when I was a lot younger, they used to do soil surveys, and we have copies of them. They don't do it this way anymore. They're not in print anymore. So there's the NRCS has a thing called
NRCS
stands for the NAT.
Yeah, I used
Natural
to
Resource Conservation Service.
Right.
Yeah, it used to be the Soil Conservation Service. So they do everything online, of course. And there's a thing called Web Survey, and you can go to it. It's not necessarily the friendliest piece of software, but you can actually zoom right in on your piece of property and ask for a soil report, and it'll tell you all the names of the soils, and it'll tell you their general characteristics. You can ask for all kinds of information, whether it's a good piece of property for a septic system, or it's good for building, or if
they really have it that detailed. That's interesting.
They have engineering properties, they have agronomic properties, they have flood potential, they have potential for erosion. It's really, when you look at it, you can spend quite a bit of time looking at it if you desire.
So that's the NRCS website.
Yes, it's called the Web Soil Survey.
And
I think I tried Googling it today to see if that was the easiest way to get to it, and it did appear that just type those two words in and you'll get there.
They
have a little green button to push, and
I'll probably be doing that tonight, just out of curiosity.
Yeah, you fall down the rabbit hole.
It's possible. Well, I have one last question. In preparing for this show, I found a number of articles addressing the subject of soil and climate change. And I know after the oceans, the soil is the next sort of largest carbon reservoir or sink for carbon on the Earth. And a number of the articles suggested that soil is one of the most reactive or maybe sensitive systems to human disturbance and climate change. And then there was a suggestion that as the planet warms, the soils could be expected to release carbon and add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere due to increased biological activity in the soil at the higher temperatures, and then that way we might expect soils as the climate warms to release more and more carbon that would then add to further global warming. So I wonder, can you just sort of give me some more information and perspective about the interrelationship between climate change and soils?
Well, I think initially just man's activity by turning the soils over with plows opened up an opportunity for the soil carbon to be released. I think one of the consequences of higher temperatures is it's a chemical reaction to some degree too, and that promotes more activity. But one good example of it, and one thing that I think we really should be concerned about, is the permafrosts that we find in Canada and Siberia. Mm-hmm. And with the increased global temperatures, if that continues to happen, as they thaw out, here's a whole new reservoir of carbon just waiting to be released. You know, it was as if when it was frozen, it's like your frozen hamburger. It's pretty stable, but once it thaws, it starts to change its properties. Mm. And I think that it's one very large example of where carbon may come. We're releasing carbon from so many different sources, but that's one that's probably looming on the horizon now.
So we'd have increasing rates of carbon release, and hence then increasing temperatures. And you've got that feedback circle that just keeps going. Oh, yeah, that could take me down another rabbit hole, but I think we'll not go there.
We can chase a different rabbit another time.
Right. So, Craig, is there any kind of one last thing you'd like to share with me about soils?
I'd say be kind to your soils. There's been a lot of work going into what can be done differently. Farmers in general, I think, are the ones that stir the pot the most, but they're looking at ways of keeping more organic matter in the soil, leaving less soil exposed, and that goes for a landowner as well, is if you can have a cover crop in the wintertime, if you can do mulching, if you can do any of a variety of things to sort of protect the soil, to keep it from being eroded, to keep it protected, those are all good things. Mm.
So whether you're a gardener or not, be kind to your soils.
Yes. That might be unique to a soil scientist.
Right.
Other people might be kind to their birds. But,
right. Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Well, thank you so much. This has been just kind of touched the surface of soils, I think.
Yes.
So the next thing is let's hear that mystery sound again. That was the call of the harlequin duck. The name harlequin is based on the so-named clown-like characters who performed in classic Italian comic theater. That's called the Commedia dell'arte. They wore costumes fashioned of patches of multicolored fabric. These characters, the harlequins, their performances were considered histrionic, that is, theatrical, perhaps a bit over the top, dramatic, maybe even melodramatic. The harlequin duck's theatrical plumage resulted in its scientific name, Histrionicus histrionicus. The adult breeding male of a harlequin duck has such a colorful and complex plumage pattern. I can really not describe it, but what I can do is say, go look at a photograph. Go Google harlequin duck images, and you'll see how spectacularly harlequin-like these ducks are. And I see them often on walks along North Beach. Looking forward to upcoming events, on Saturday, October 3rd, the Jefferson Land Trust Geology Group presents a talk on the rising sea level, projections, and coastal impacts, and that'll be held at the Quimper Unitarian Universalist Fellowship.
The reading selection for the Jefferson Land Trust Natural History Society Book Club for October is The Wild Trees by Richard Preston. Check out the Land Trust's website for more details about the Natural History Society Book Club.
And on Tuesday, October 6th at 7 p.m., attend a special presentation and book signing at the Port Townsend Public Library. Northwest author Thor Hansen will be there talking about his latest book titled The Triumph of Seeds. In The Triumph of Seeds, Hansen explores both the natural and cultural history of seeds, why they're so dominant in nature, and why we are so utterly dependent upon them. Reviewers say that The Triumph of Seeds is a book of knowledge, adventure, and wonder, essential reading for anyone who loves plants or may have wondered how the chili got its spice, what puts the buzz in coffee, or how seeds have influenced everything from the voyages of Christopher Columbus to the Industrial Revolution to the shape of the human face. And just before I came to the studio today, I found another upcoming event that I'm wanting to attend. It's on October 7th. It's in Seattle at the Seattle Aquarium. Carl Safina, who is an acclaimed scientist and an award-winning author, is giving the keynote address for an evening discussion, and it'll be a panel discussion, I understand, on the orca-salmon connection in the Pacific Northwest. And Dr. Safina will be talking about his new book, which is entitled Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. That's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news of the natural community where we live. And just to let you know, Nature Now is looking for folks who might be interested in joining our team of hosts and interviewers. Contact us at Nature Now, again, one word, naturenow@kptz.org for more information. I can say for myself that I never, ever thought I might become involved in radio, but it has been tremendous fun, and I thoroughly enjoy not only our great team, but every week having the opportunity to explore something new. Nature Now airs noon on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the website.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music is Back to the Earth by Jason Mraz.
Whenever my head starts to hurt, before it goes from bad to feeling worse, I turn off my phone, I get down low, and put my hands in the dirt. I try to stop the world from moving so fast, try to get a grip on where I'm at, and simplify this dizzy life, and put my feet in the grass. I'm going back to the earth. I'm going back to the earth. I'm going back to work. I'm going back to the earth. For a high rise must mean that everybody wants to get high and move on up to a deluxe apartment in the sky. Well, the higher we go, the taller we grow, we lose sight of the land below. Well, you can have your places in outer space, 'cause my home is where my food is grown. I'm going back to the earth. I'm going back.